hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say yes, that you will be persuaded to say yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight we have Bill Sanders returning to NAVA Club. Since I only have about 3 years in the program and have been involved a little less than that with the speaker program, but Bill was one of the first speakers that that I recorded, and it really made a big impact on my life. And also, when I picked up my white chip, the speaker that night was one of his sponsees, and he gave me Bill's number. He said, "Bill's kind of, he's probably not accepting new sponsees, but you ought to give him a call, and maybe he can send you in the right direction." I left him a voicemail, and within 30 minutes, he called me back, and he gave me a good chunk of time, and it really made a big difference in my early sobriety. So thank you, Bill. It's great to see you again. Welcome back to NAVA.
I am Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight, and that's the single most important thing that I can share with you from this podium tonight, that it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have awakened for the last 10,175 mornings without a hangover. Now, knowing how the alcoholic mind works, if I don't tell you what that computes to, you're going to spend the next hour trying to calculate it. That computes to July 26, 1982. It's humbling to speak in this room, because I detoxed in this room almost 28 years ago. And if I'm not dealt enough humility with that being the case, then you stick these two old codgers here in front of me, Larry Klinger and Bill Roop, who were around when I got here. And they used to sit in meetings when I would share, and as I would share, they would smile at each other and nod, which I thought was so, they were approving of every word I said. It wasn't until later that I figured out they were saying, "He's here, and if he keeps coming back, he'll get it sooner or later." But these two men have been giants in my recovery, and always will be. And I'm grateful, have always been grateful to have these men in my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an unashamed Alcoholics Anonymous cheerleader. Now, I can tell you, when I was a little kid growing up in the hills of North Georgia, and I was making a list of all the clubs and organizations that I wanted to be a part of when I grew up, Alcoholics Anonymous was not in the Hot 100. But I can tell you today, you can have every club, every organization, every honor I've ever received. You can have them all if you leave me Alcoholics Anonymous. All of these other things gave me temporary honor. They gave me temporary refuge in some quasi-exclusive group. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me life. A life that I had never had. A life that I never understood. Now, that is not to say that I was impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous from the very first time I was exposed to it. The very first AA meeting I went to, several years before I got sober, I had a friend who was in the program. And we happened to be having lunch one day, and he was saying he was going to an AA. He had to finish up lunch because he was going to an AA meeting after lunch. It was like a 1 o'clock meeting. And I said, "Well, anyway, I could go with you, just see what it's like." He said, "Sure, come on." And we went to the meeting, and they read all this stuff that I didn't understand any of at the beginning. And they went through the meeting, and a bunch of people shared about a bunch of stuff. At the end of the meeting, they brought this woman up to the front of the room, and they started applauding her, and they said some nice things about her. And I'm leaning over to my friend and said, what is this going on here?" "Oh, this is Elsie's 24th birthday." She looked a lot older than that to me. And then they gave her a poker chip. And a couple of people brought out this little cake and gave it to her. And everybody went nuts. And I asked my friend, I said, well, I don't understand what. He said, well, let me put it to you this way. If you don't drink for a year, we'll do that for you. I said, now let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake. Wow. I couldn't wait to get out of there. Bunch of nuts. It was several more years before I walked through the door to stay. I was born in a little community in northeast Georgia. They used to say in my little hometown there were three things you could do on a Saturday night. You could watch them unload the truck at the A&P. You could sit down beneath the water tank and watch it leak. Or you could cross the Savannah River into South Carolina and buy beer and drink. Now, you got to know, I did not arrive at AA from too much water tank watching. One Saturday night, some friends said, out of curiosity, of pressure, I don't know, they said, do you want to go to Carolina and get some beer with us? And I said, sure. And we pulled into this little beer joint, and you could pull around behind it, honk the horn three times, and if the guy would come out, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we bought a case of what I think I remember was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And we went back and sat on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River. And somebody took one of those, you know, you kids don't even know what I'm talking about, when I said a church key, and popped open that beer. There were no pop tops back then. And handed me that beer, and I took a big swallow. And it was beyond a shadow of a doubt the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth, which probably explains why I only drank six that night. I got drunk the first night that I drank. And I also had set into motion that night a set of beliefs that were to carry me for many, many years. And that is the belief that alcohol affected everybody who drinks the same way that it affects me. I have since learned it doesn't. There are many people out there tonight that will have a couple of drinks, and it won't alter their perception of reality. It won't change the way they think and act. They merely have a couple of drinks, they relax, they go to bed, watch the Tonight Show, and wake up tomorrow with another normal day. My life was never that way after that Saturday night. It also helped to explain questions that I have never understood. For example, I've never understood those people who say, no more for me, one's my limit. That is the dumbest remark I ever heard in my life. I have never wanted one of anything. But the one that really got me, and still does to this very day, is the person who says, no, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. I don't get that. I never did, and I never will. Those people who talk like that never understood me, and they never will. And for many, many years, I thought nobody ever would. Because I felt like, from the very earliest memories that I have, a feeling of being on the outside looking in, of somehow feeling different, somehow feeling like I didn't belong, that somehow everybody else around me seemed to have something within them that I was missing. And I couldn't fathom what it was. So I began what I now call, in looking back, my search for it. I felt that if I could ever find it, I would be okay. I felt that if I could ever just put my hands on that it that was missing in me and I could get it in me, then I could be like other people. But I have to tell you, that's a tough search when you don't know what it is. For many years, I thought it was money, if I just had enough money. And at various times in my career, before I retired, I made a great deal of money, relatively speaking. I got to the point where I could buy almost anything I wanted, and did. But that most assuredly was not it. I thought if I had enough stuff, the biggest, the best, the widest, the tallest, I thought enough of the right stuff would be it. It was not. So the search went on and on and on, and I made all kinds of substitutions in my mind for what it was, and went about my life. I should backtrack and point out that, as I said a moment ago, I retired about 4 years ago. And that was after spending 50 years in the profession that I found myself in. And I say that because at the age of 13, I became a small-town radio disc jockey. Supposedly at that time, the youngest disc jockey in America. That record has long since been broken. But I went into the business of broadcasting. I was a young DJ, smart aleck on the air, spinning rock and roll records and bumping my gums. And everybody who listened to me on the radio every day, assuming there were some people out there listening, assumed that that character on the radio was who I was. They didn't know that that was a scared little boy hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone, alone in a studio, being what I perceived my audience wanted me to be. Now, I was only a disc jockey for a few years and went into other aspects of broadcasting and news and talk shows and management. But that pattern continued till I became the ultimate people pleaser. I would be whatever I perceived you wanted me to be. I could change philosophies, religion, politics, anything in my life with a drop of a hat. Because I wanted to be loved. And in order to do so, I must be exactly what you wanted me to be. To the extent that by the time I arrived at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had completely lost myself. I didn't have a clue who I was or what I believed. If I had properly done things in the morning when I would walk into the office and greet people, if I had done it the way I really felt, what you would have heard come out of my mouth was, "Good morning, Bill. How am I doing today?" Because I depended on you to tell me, "Am I okay?" Because in my mind, I was never okay. As I said, I spent 50 years in broadcasting, and decided that was long enough. And so about 4 years ago, I retired. And I looked back over the years, and I've had a lot of friends tell me I should write a book. I'm afraid that too many things that are in that book would land me in jail. So I hesitate to do that. But I had a lot of crazy experiences during my drinking career and my working career. One incident I'll have to report to you secondhand because I was only there in body and not in mind. I was invited along with another significant group of broadcasters to a reception at the White House. And they had an open bar, and I availed myself of it freely. And thankfully, some friends of me ushered me out of the White House just before I had a chance to tell President Reagan the ideas that I had for straightening out America. I'll always resent them doing that, because I'm quite sure some of those ideas were bound to have been good. We'll never know. Another time when I was working down the street here at WSB Radio in news, The news director came in one Saturday afternoon and said, grab a tape recorder, go down to the Henry Grady Hotel. You guys remember that hotel, don't you? Go down to the Henry Grady Hotel and do an interview. I said, who am I going to interview? He said, you're going to interview Lyndon Johnson. Get going. I grabbed the tape recorder, jump in the mobile unit, and I start downtown. I'm thinking, ain't no way you can do this without a little fortification. Stopped at one of my neighborhood water holes and had a couple of quick shooters. Got in the car, went on down to the hotel, got on the elevator. Stopped on the floor where he was to be, and I was greeted at the elevator by the Secret Service and was frisked and my credentials checked, and they went through my gear to make sure it was all proper. Then they ushered me into the suite of this palatial hotel room. And this giant of a man grabbed me by the hand and pulled me into the room and said, have a seat, son. And I sat down on a sofa. There was a coffee table here and then another sofa. And he sat on the other sofa looking across at me. And I couldn't help notice on the coffee table between us was a cup of glasses and a bottle of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this thing, let's have ourselves a little snort. What do you say? Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full, and he poured his glass full. And I have to tell you at this point, back then you didn't just walk in and sit down and interview the president. You had to do what was known as the pre-interview interview. That's where you tell him what you're going to ask him, and he tells you whether or not he'll answer it. So when you start recording, everything goes smoothly. They don't get away with that today, but they did back then. And we start talking, I ask questions, and he comes back at me with some answers or the lack thereof. And I take three or four sips of that drink, and as soon as I do, he picks that bottle up and fills it up again. And we talk on there about 10 or 15 minutes, and suddenly it hits me. My God, that man is drunker than you are. A couple of more minutes, he says, turn that thing on, let's do it. I turned on the tape recorder and we started the interview, and it was a good interview. I'm told that a copy of it still exists down at WSB. Maybe someday I'll get the guts to listen to it. I doubt it, though. It went well. I asked intelligent questions. He came back with great answers. The interview went very smoothly until I got to a point in the interview where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Give me that water, Bill. Now, it's at this point that I can always gauge the age of the audience. People who don't remember that her name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. Those are just a couple of incidences out of probably hundreds that happened to me or that I happened to over the years that I was in broadcasting. Along the way, I met a beautiful young girl. Decided I wanted her to be a permanent part of my life, and so I said, you know, you probably need to cut down on your drinking. A couple of dates, realized that was not necessary at all, that she liked to drink just as much as I did, and our marriage was off and running. A few years into our marriage, we were blessed with a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby girl, and we were determined to become model parents. But unfortunately, my disease by now was in full bloom, and it had other plans. And we discovered the American Institution of the Babysitter, and we were right back in bars and partying. By now, I was beginning to be in a phase of the business that required me to do a great deal of traveling, and I would travel by air most of the time, which was difficult for me because I used to say I had a fear of flying. I've since learned to realize, come to realize, I did not have a fear of flying. I had a fear of falling. And I would always get out to Hartsfield Airport an hour or so earlier so I could stop at the bar and have a couple of drinks before I get on the plane so I can get fortified. You did that time or two, didn't you, bud? Which was fine. And it worked. Except when I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, some years ago, some of you may remember, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had a series of commercials that ran that, ironically, I voiced a number of those commercials as they ran on television. I did a simple voiceover. And my line on that commercial was, "Delta is ready when you are." Uh-uh. They lied. They'll leave you in a heartbeat. So I did what any other good drunk would do. I just get on an airplane and go somewhere else. Called home that night. "How's the convention in New York?" "I don't know. I'm not in New York." "Where are you?" "I'm in New Orleans." Don't remember getting there. More and more often I would wake up in strange beds in strange places with strange people. More and more bizarre behavior that I could never explain once I came out of the hangover. And by now, my disease had outfitted me with a set of glasses, blinders, I called them, that allowed me only to see what my disease wanted me to see. For example, those blinders did not allow me to see that the only look that was ever in my little girl's eyes, who by now is 5 and 6 years old, the only look in her eyes was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. The blinders didn't allow me to see that she never invited friends over to spend the night because she never knew when Dad's going to come home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, throwing televisions through plate glass windows, dragging her out of bed, belittling her, and verbally abusing her. Even when I was changing a mattress on my little girl's bed and I found a diary underneath the old mattress, and I did what I shouldn't have done, I opened it and started reading. And the words jumped off the page, "I wish my daddy was dead, and maybe there'd be some peace in our home." But the blinders were firmly in place. And they remained in place until I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was blessed by going to a number of Al-Anon meetings, and I still enjoy going to Al-Anon meetings, to help me to realize that the tentacles of my disease had a reach far beyond anything I could have imagined. That the turbulence that my disease created reached out and touched every person that I came in contact with, whether it was at work, socially, at home, most of all at home. And yet those blinders made me believe, okay, I may have a drinking problem, but it's none of your business. And I convinced myself of that completely. I was convinced for a long time that I was a social drinker until I came to realize that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. And I believed that. I also was a snob. I felt that I always liked to take people to the restaurants where I entertained business clients in downtown Atlanta that were the fanciest restaurants in town with a deep pile of carpet, and I could walk through the door of the foyer to the restaurant and the maitre d' and his tux would greet me at the door by name, usher me to the door of the lounge, and I'd walk through the lounge. The bartender would call my name, and by the time I reached my usual seat, he had my drink on the bar waiting for me. And I love taking people with me to see that, because I felt like that made a statement. I know tonight it made a statement, all right. Just not the one I thought it was making. I was also a snob in believing that the optimum temperature for drinking vodka was 31.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I've since learned that is incorrect. The optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 108 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the temperature underneath the front seat of my car where I kept that bottle. I always thought of myself as a responsible, classy drinker. I'm going to tell you something. When you wake up in the morning and you look down and you blink your eyes and realize there's dew all over your clothes, and you blink again and realize you're looking out from underneath a bush in Piedmont Park, and you blink once more and realize you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse. There is no class in that whatsoever. There's no, also no good answer to the question of what are you doing here? All I could think of was, where is here? There's no class when you're pulled from a steel post that you planted your car into on the side of an Atlanta City street. And you're frisked and cuffed and put into that cage. All the way to the jail, I'm talking to this cop. I'm telling him, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. I am not drunk. I have only had two beers. You're making a big mistake. I am no way I'm drunk. He seemed oblivious to my whole discussion. A little aside here, something I became convinced of a few years ago, and we'll see if some of y'all agree with me. I became convinced a few years ago that there's this school that every alcoholic at some point in time, when they're in a blackout, we're whisked off to this little school, and at the school they only teach one course. And what they teach is, if you ever stop by the cops, never admit to more than two beers. Case in point, you ever watch these cop shows on TV? They'll pull a guy out of the car, he goes kablap on the ground. Pick him up, prop him up against the car. Mister, you had a little too much to drink? No, two beers. Over and over and over and over again. Wife and I a few months ago watching it. They pull this guy out of the car, prop him up against the car. He slid down, boom, on the ground. Hey, fella, had a little too much to drink tonight. No, no, I hadn't had but three beers on. Oh, God, he missed class. But all the way to the police station, to jail, this, I'm telling this cop, don't go through with this. You're making a big mistake. He took me in, put me on that breathalyzer. I blew on it as seriously as I could. Registered .28. I said, officer, let me tell you right now, you're making a big mistake because there is absolutely no way on the face of this earth that I could be registering .28 on two beers. The cop agreed with me. I can assure you it was the only thing we agreed on that night. It is also not classy, nor is it smart, to go to court for a DUI drunk. If you've never done it, don't. Judges don't like it. I had a friend who was a lawyer, and he told me, he said, all right, this is your first DUI. All you got to do is when they call your name, ask, how do you plead? You say, Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere. Okay, what does that mean? He said, that means you're pleading no contest, not guilty, not innocent, just nolo contendere. They'll slap you on the wrist, give you a little fine, and you go on your way. Okay. I'm sitting in that courtroom, sweating like crazy. The whole room is spinning around. The guy finally calls, the bailiff calls my name. Mr. Sanders, how do you plead? Your Honor, I plead guilty. And he threw the book at me. We reached a point in our lives where my wife went in her direction and I went in my direction. We were seldom together. We reached a point where I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days. She didn't ask where I'd been, didn't care. And the same was true with her. So one night when I'm sitting in my recliner chair at home and sitting there with a bottle in my hand staring at the TV, my wife gets in her car and leaves, and she's gone for about 2.5 hours. About 2.5 hours, she comes walking back into the room. I'm still sitting there with that bottle in my hand, still staring at the TV, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And my wife came and stood in front of me, and guess where I've been? I said, who cares? And she did something really weird. She didn't say a word. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it, and I looked back at her again. And I said, I don't know where you've been, But if that's all you won, you had a lousy night. Well, she told me she had been to an A&A meeting. And I went into a flying pluperfect rage because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's all there was to it. But she didn't care what I thought. She started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to fall. I kept waiting for her to say, you need this worse than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am. Not a word. Just going to meetings. Going to meetings. Going to meetings. Sometimes up to 3 a day. Not a word. There were a few little clues left around the house. For example, I go in and lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works taped to the lid. If you don't believe that, ask Ruth. Ruth asked her one time, did she really do that? And she did. The roller coaster ride of my alcoholism grew and grew. The search for it continued. I reached the point I thought if I could just find the right woman, that would be definitely it. I knew the one I'm married to wasn't it. So I would go to bars, and I lived a lot in bars. And I'd sit down at one end of the bar and look at the other end of the bar, and I'd see this gorgeous vision of loveliness at the other end of the bar. And I would sit there for 5 or 6 minutes rehearsing what was going to be the greatest come-on line in the history of mankind that couldn't fail. And I'd practice, and I'd practice, and I'd practice. When I had it just right, I would slip off the stool, go down to the other end of the bar, slip onto the empty stool next to her, turn and look into her beautiful, gorgeous pools of loveliness, her eyes, and say to her, I find a baby, date. And I knew she was it because she said, yeah. Next morning, she wasn't it. On Monday evening, July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Entire week missing. And I had remembered one additional AA meeting that I'd gone to, and that's when my wife picked up a 90-day chip. She had pleaded and cried and all that to get me to go, and I had gone. And after the meeting, I had met a man in the parking lot that I had heard talk in the meeting. He was a little different from everybody else. They asked this man, this man grabbed me by the shoulders. I went across the parking lot and spun me around and started talking to me. Now, I'm trying to get away from this place as fast as I can. I went in my own car so I wouldn't have to hang around with my wife and all those other people. Nuts. And this guy grabbed me by the shoulder and started talking and talking and talking and talking. And I'm thinking, my God, what is he talking to me for? The man don't even know who I am. Found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. This man had identified himself a little differently from other people in the room, and when I say this, some of you are going to remember him. He identified himself by saying, howdy, my name's Floyd, and I'm a Grateful Hillbilly drunk. See, mighty, you remember him. And he talks to me about his fifth grade education and about his drinking moonshine up in the mountains and about his DUI he got driving the school bus. I'm inching toward my car as fast as I can. My wife comes out. Other people come out and get in their cars and leave. My wife comes out, looks over to where we're standing, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. And he talks about getting drunk out in the woods in the wintertime and about falling down on the ground, his face freezing to the ground, and they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. and I'm not hearing most of this because I'm busy making a deal with God. I finally, about 2.5 days later, got away from him. Seemed like it anyway. I got in my car and I drove home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, "Don't open your mouth." And she didn't. And that roller coaster ride continued. And as I came out of that week-long blackout drunk on July 26, 1982, the thought going through my head was, is this all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And a voice came through that fog. The voice of an angel? Not really. The voice of God? Not exactly. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk by the name of Floyd. And the words that cut through that hangover were simply this. I remember Floyd saying, "When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out." And if where I was on that day is any closer to hell on this earth, I hope I never know it. I've got to do a little aside here right now. This past fall, 27 and a half years after that night, Floyd's son asked me to do the eulogy at his memorial service. And I was able to stand in front of several hundred people and talk about the thousands of lives that Floyd touched in his more than 45 years in this program. And I was able to say that I believe that on the Saturday before that, God did open the gates of heaven and let Floyd in and said, "Welcome home, my good and faithful servant." What more could we as alcoholics ask for? I got up out of that chair that Monday evening, and I went in the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could. I gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine, drank the rest. Went back to that same little clubhouse, which was the 8111 clubhouse on the hill in Roswell Road that many of you know of. And I walked into the room. Now, God of my understanding has a sense of humor. I don't know about yours. But sitting there when I peeked around the post at the front of the room, sitting there chairing the meeting, was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting when I got up and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room, and a man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating hand. And I walked back and sat down. I choose to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because I said at the beginning, by the grace of God, the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this, and especially this one, I haven't had a drink since that night. And God placed into my life people like Bill Roop, Larry Klinger, and one who was most of all placed in front of my face, a man by the name of Doc Crandall, who became my first sponsor. Doc was only my sponsor for 3.5 years, and yet it seemed like a lifetime, because my life changed more in those 3.5 years than the rest of my life before it put together. I don't know if I spent more time loving him from the bottom of my heart or hating his guts. Because you see, I picked him as a sponsor because he was a sweet-looking old granddaddy type that I thought would pat me on the head every day and say what a good job I was doing. I remember him telling me very little that I wanted to hear. But he told me a hell of a lot that I needed to hear. Many times I would drive home from his house cussing him all the way. And I'd go in a day and a half and pick up the phone, call him. He'd say, "Come on over here." As a lot of people in this fellowship know, Doc went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young alcoholic that Doc had been trying to help, the gun accidentally discharged and Doc caught the blast in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. He gave his life doing what he'd rather be doing than anything on earth, and that's trying to help another drunk. That night in his den, I felt a loneliness come over me that I had not felt in a long time. How could I go on? How could I stay sober without the man who planted me in this fellowship, who introduced me to those steps, who walked me face to face with a God that I never understood but now began to? How could I go on? In the quiet stillness of that evening, the answer came. You do it by doing what he taught you to do. And what his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor before him taught him, all the way back to that fateful night on May 11th, 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been surgeon looked at each other and said, "Do you think we might stay sober if we help one another?" I happen to believe we're the luckiest people that walk the face of God's earth today. I believe God, in his infinite and compassionate wisdom in 1935, or if you prefer, in 1934 when Bill got sober, looked down and said, "The lowly alcoholic has suffered for long enough. I've got to give him a way out." And what a way he gave us. He could have said, "Treat them like lepers, lock them off in a colony so they can't contaminate the world around them." He could have said, "Lock them up in jails and throw away the keys," and many of us were and should have stayed. He could have done so many things, such as just condemn us to immediate death, but instead he did none of those. Instead he gave us each other. And with that, more love, more laughter, more joy, more happiness than most of us could have ever dreamed of in 1,000 lifetimes. And you'll never convince this alcoholic that he didn't give us one more thing. I believe he gave us a one-on-one relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. How would I go on? Well, I went on by having the greatest little old bunch of snot-nosed sponsees ring the wagons around me than I could ever imagine. Those little dickens dragged me to meetings when I wanted to hide. They made me share when I wanted to isolate. They loved me, they carried me, and they walked with me until I could walk the walk again myself. And I will love them eternally for that. The next year and a half after Doc's death, I did something that I do not recommend at all. Please hear me if you hear nothing else I say. For the next year and a half, I sponsored myself. And I won't go into any details of that year and a half other than to say when I awakened, I realized that I had a fool for a sponsor. And I had an even bigger fool for a sponsee. And I ended up through a crazy set of circumstances that are a whole story within itself to asking a man by the name of Paul Oliger to be my sponsor. The name may not mean anything to you unless you dig pretty deeply into the big book. Paul Oliger's name was Dr. Paul, and he's the author of Acceptance is the Answer, or Before Dr. Alcoholic Addict. And I was so fortunate to have that beautiful little man and his wife Max in my life for the last 10 years of his life. He died 10 years ago, day before yesterday, of a very sudden aneurysm. He taught me so much about acceptance, not just of the world around me, but of myself. He taught me what peace there is in serenity in acceptance of the world as it is. He and his wife Max taught my wife and I so much about how to happy ever after together. I should tell you that in December the 30th of 1982, my wife and I were to sign divorce papers. Instead, we stood in front of the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows and we started all over again. And I can tell you tonight that that woman is my lover, my friend, my pal, my soulmate, and the person I would rather be with than anybody on the face of this earth. We've been happily ever after egged out for 43 years, working on 44. Everything has not been peachy for the last 28 years. Things are difficult now. My wife is battling lung cancer. She's going through chemotherapy, and that's the reason she's not here tonight. But we've received word of literally several thousands of prayers from all over the world for her in her recovery. The vast majority of them from friends and family in this fellowship. But you see, I have friends today beyond anything I could ever imagine were possible. Friends that who would and have and continue to do anything in the world we need to be done. And I cannot imagine any of my old bar buddies stepping out of their way to do anything. I feel like Lou Gehrig when he said, "I am the happiest and luckiest man on the face of this earth because of what I have in my life." My little girl who hated her daddy's guts, I walked her down the aisle at her wedding. Some years after that wedding, she placed a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby boy in my arms and said, "Meet your grandpa, he's the greatest." And a couple of years after that, she put a little brown-eyed, brown-haired baby boy in my arms and said, "Here, Dad, guess what? We gave him your name." What a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the insidious, relentless, uncaring disease called alcoholism. But against that which I've been fortunate enough to surround myself with, it doesn't stand a chance. Because the love and the fellowship, the power of the steps, the instructions of that little book that we read and call the Big Book, blocks my disease from pulling me down. And if I do what I'm told in the middle of page 85, that what I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and if I touch base with that God that you introduced me to every day, and I ask for direction from Him, I can't lose. We talk about blind faith. I think all faith is blind, because if I can see around the next corner is what's coming, I don't need faith. Faith is stepping off the curb in the dark. And a lot that's going on in our lives today is in the dark. But I believe in a God who has brought me from a long, long way away where I was 28 years ago. And after a couple of suicide attempts that failed, I must be here for a reason. And so must she, and so must all of us. I'm very grateful to be in this room again. I feel a lot of humility because I remember when I was trembling and crying and every other conceivable emotion that suddenly came alive in me way back when. To be back here tonight, to be able to say, they were right. It works. It really, really works. And the prayer that I prayed this morning is a part of the prayers that I pray every day. I simply say, God, thank you. Because I almost missed all of this. Thank you for having me tonight.
Thank you, Bill. That was a great way to spend Memorial Day for me personally, and I'm sure everybody else would agree with that. And best wishes to your wife's recovery. And the seventh tradition: every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Your generous donations support this group and AA as own. Do we have any AA related announcements? Yes, Brian.
Hey,
Brian.
I received a letter from Canada. I'll be in Canada after the meeting.
Okay. See Brian for literature? Any others? It's got to be something, right? Good. Next week, Jeremy C. tells his story. Member of Biscayne's Last Resort Group. But we see him often at the 545 and other meetings right here. And really looking forward to hearing his, what he has to say. And then the week after that, M. Glad to be here. Glad to be any damn where. M from the Heavy Hitters Group. So,
MP.
Yeah, MP. Exactly. All right. And that's going to be on June 14th, 2 weeks from now. So, we still have a good roster. We do have an opening coming up in July. So, if you would like to get in July or August, let me know after the meeting. And if there's nothing else, I'd like to remind everybody that Anna... Chips, what up? So see ya. We'll give out the chips.
My name's Cecilia, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm truly grateful to be here. I don't usually get an opportunity to come to a speaker meeting on Monday night, but thank you very much, Bill. It's truly inspiring. We have a chip system to mark our milestones in sobriety, and we offer a white chip for surrender, or if you want to try this new way of life just for today. Would anybody else care to try just for today? When you've got 30 days, we offer a silver chip for 30 days and nights of sobriety. For 90 days, we have a red chip. Does anybody have 90 days? For 6 months, we have a yellow chip. For 9 months, we have a green chip. And for 1 year or many years, we have a blue chip. Anybody celebrating a birthday? And then we offer the white chip again. Thank God for the chip.
Great job. Thank you, Cecilia. That's the way you do it, Cecilia. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to close the meeting now. Do you have anything to say, Tim?
Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm an alcoholic. Mr. Bill, everybody interested in the Atlanta Men's Workshop, should talk to Bill after the meeting. Information on that, particularly new people who want to check that out. And also, a couple of people who helped Tim and clean up that deal, we appreciate it.
Yeah, your help is greatly appreciated. And I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions that remind us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Jesse, would you take us out, please?
After a moment of silence for the alcoholic who was suffering in and out of the room, let this circle represent what we do together and not apart. Who woke us up this morning?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Teach him back
God, your words and your words.
And words.
Yes.
Thank you
sure do.
I thought you were calling.
Just a second.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to see you, Bill. Thank you.
I'm